Good morning, Your Honors. I represent Jason Gerhardt, one of the three defendants in this appeal. This is a case where there was serious overcharging and vague charging language, which led to prejudicial constitutional error implicating my client's double jeopardy and due process rights. Now, under the Supreme Court test in Blockberger v. United States, the two conspiracy charges, one is 18 U.S.C. 372, which was a specific conspiracy charge prescribing a person threatening, forcing, or intimidating the U.S. Marshals from carrying out their official duties, and the second one was 18 U.S.C. 371, which is the general conspiracy statute, in this case incorporating a language from 18 U.S.C. 111A1, which prescribes a person from impeding, opposing, intimidating, or interfering with law enforcement in the discharge of their duties. The language of those two sections, 111A and 372, is indistinguishable. It is
well, may I interrupt you there? I'm not sure that I disagree with you with your bottom line, but I'm just looking at the quotations that you set out on page 4 of your brief. And it seems to me that they are distinguishable in the sense that, at least as you have set it out, count one, in effect, charges conspiracy to impede in arresting. Count two charges a similar conspiracy, but under 2A, as I understand it, it requires force in resisting, impeding, and so on. Force isn't required, as I understand it, under count one. So it looks to me, based on the way you've set out the elements in your brief, that count 2A, in fact, requires one element that one doesn't, and that is force.
Well,
and if that's, let me just finish my sentence, and then you take it from there. If that's the case, count 1 technically is a lesser included offense of count 2A. Now you still got a Blockberger problem. I don't mean you're wrong there, but am I wrong to read, in effect, your quotations as indicating that 2A is the superior offense because it has the forcible element, and that count 1 is in fact technically lesser included because it charges the same thing but without force?
I think that both statutes actually require the use of force, threat, or intimidation.
Well, that is not shown in the quotations on page 4. That's where
I'm getting. No, if you look at page 19 of the government's brief, the government acknowledges that, where it says, as defendants recognize, section 372 requires a conspiracy to prevent any person from discharging the duties of his federal office by force, intimidation, or threat. So the actual language of both statutes require the element of force or threat or intimidation. So to that extent,
and I take it that was charged in count one?
Yes, it was.
Okay, so, and I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but the quotation that you've got on page 4 on count one simply doesn't include everything then.
Right, it may not have.
Okay.
Because what actually it says on the 372 count in the indictment, paragraph 7, it says to prevent by force, intimidation, and threat employees. So they both require force, intimidation, and threat.
But the only one requires preventing the discharge of duties, and the other requires interfering with someone in the midst of their discharge of duties. Isn't that correct?
Right, but it's hard to parse out the difference between the two, particularly looking at this particular case where the actual acts of the clients were all threats to prevent the marshals from undertaking their actions. So it was actually to what the government is saying the difference is that the 372 count, if you read it, is they were trying to prescribe the defendants from their conduct which threatened that if the marshals were to carry out their duties, they would interfere. They would prevent the marshals from carrying out their duties or interfere with that.
But counsel, if as Chief Judge Lynch suggests, preventing and interfering, all right, have different legal significations. The fact that the defendant's conduct in this case might happen to violate both of those charges wouldn't itself create a double jeopardy problem. We have to look to the elements of the offense as charged, don't we?
Right, but they both have in them.
They have commonalities, but what about the base? You still haven't spoken in general to the basic semantic difference between prevention and interference.
Well, because, first of all, the one distinction is that actually 372, the first one, the one that prevents, also incorporates the word interfere with and intimidate. And it seems to me that the two of them are synonymous in that if you're interfering with somebody from carrying out their duties, it is exactly synonymous with preventing them or interfering with them from actually doing their duties. It's hard to parse out, and the example of it is, the way to look at it is you have to step back and look at the facts of this case.
Well,
and I don't think you can parse it.
No, that's an inherent flaw.
Yeah.
We don't start with the facts of the case, as Judge Selya just said. Given conduct can violate different statutes. We start with the elements of the statute. So can you please go back to that?
See, the government suggests that the distinction is temporal, that prevention is something that occurs before the officers undertake their duties, and interference is something that occurs in the midst of the officers' performance of their duties.
And I submit that that's semantic. That in fact they're the same. That 372, the conduct that Congress intended to prescribe by 372, is the very same conduct that was intended to be prescribed by 111A, and that they can be and are used interchangeably. And if you look at the closing argument of the government, they recognize that because they say there was one conspiracy. I don't think you can separate out the temporal element from these charges. I think, in fact, the elements are exactly the same. I don't think you can posit a situation where one would apply and one would not apply. And if that's the case, then the elements to prove them.
You easily can. One can easily hypothesize somebody who takes steps to prevent the marshals from doing anything at all. And then that's unsuccessful. The marshals then go on, and they're in the midst of trying to call this person before the court for sentencing, and they choose to interfere with the marshal at that point.
But in fact, if you're threatening to prevent the marshals from doing anything, you're actually engaging in the violated 111 conduct, because you're preventing them from actually doing their work. It's the same thing. If you're preventing them from coming in and doing their work, it's the same as preventing them from doing their work. And that's what this is. This is one seamless conduct. There was no two steps involved.
So your argument is on some facts, the two are synonymous. On other facts, they are not.
I don't believe that. I believe there's synonymous.
I just gave you an example of an instance in which they were not.
But that would also apply to 111, because if you're preventing from doing their acts, presumably they're doing something towards doing their acts that's being prevented, which is the 111 violation. So you're saying
that, I don't want to extend the analogy too far, but going back to the early colloquy that you and I had, if I understand you now, you're saying preventing includes interfering.
It doesn't.
And so it's kind of a broad category. Preventing is a broad category. Interfering is a more limited but included category.
I think that is correct. And, in fact, the language of the statute has both. And what's interesting is the actual language of 372 actually includes almost the precise language of Section 111A. It's omitted from part of the indictment, and it's not mentioned in the government's brief, but 372 goes on beyond the several words that are actually enumerated in the indictment. 372 itself really pretty much tracks 3 of 111A. I don't think that you can make a realistic difference between preventing the marshals from undertaking their acts and interfering with them once they've started doing their acts, because they're both part of one course of action. And to prevent them from doing their acts, to interfere with them from doing their acts, is to actually keep them from doing their acts, which is 111A. To me, they're precisely the same. Thank you. I see my time is up, so I didn't get to my other arguments. I'll rest on my brief.
You used it efficiently.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Sven Weberg. I'm here for Mr. Riley. Mr. Riley was, in effect, subjected to catch 66 or catch 88 while going through the star chamber. I mean, it was a number of just one catch 22, one, you know, you can't, heads I win, tails you lose situations from the get-go. He shows up in the Northern District of New York. They send in a federal defender, and that's a good thing. The system that we have on the federal level actually sends in the defender, whereas most of the state level, in New Hampshire at least, they have to wait until somebody requests one. But a federal defender shows up. He's told in no uncertain terms, I don't want you. I'm going to represent myself. And that's on the record from the notes that were sent, the docket entries that were sent along to New Hampshire. A couple days later, he's in New Hampshire. Once again, a CJA attorney is sent in. Mr. Riley doesn't know at the time.
Is this in furtherance of your argument he had a right to represent himself, and that his choice on the eve of trial to go forward with counsel counsel and not just standby counsel was somehow invalid?
Oh, well, that's part of it.
Which argument are you making?
That's part of it. It's actually both. He's got both rights. Ferretta lays it out. He's got a right to represent himself.
All right. How is that right violated?
Because he said from the get-go, he told...
He can change his mind, and the trial judge found that he had changed his mind.
But by that time, there had already been horrible prejudice. His case was shot to pieces at that point because he'd been appointed somebody who he refused. In the first meeting with Mark Howard, a former assistant United States attorney, Mark Howard, Mark Howard was told, I don't want you. I want to represent myself. The hearing was, the part of the hearing that had to do with detention was continued, as they often are, to give a little bit of time. And a couple days later, we're back. Mr. Howard meets with Mr. Riley again and is told again, I don't want you. I want to represent
myself. Mr. Howard did not represent him at trial. Eventually, Howard is out of the case, and then there is new standby counsel. Is that you?
That was me.
All right. All right. So at some point, you became trial counsel. Your client chose to have you.
It certainly wasn't in any way something you could describe as his voluntary and well thought out and planned choice.
For a criminal defendant, particularly in a complicated case, to represent himself and then to change his mind are really well thought out. That's not the test. The test is whether his wishes were effectuated, and it seems that when the judge in New Hampshire learned of his wish not to be represented by Mr. Howard, the judge permitted him, as the Constitution required, to go pro se. And when the judge subsequently was informed by Mr. Riley that he had concluded that it wasn't efficient or effective for him to go pro se, the judge, who had prudently appointed standby counsel, then appointed standby counsel as full counsel to represent him. So like the chief judge, I'm struggling with the notion of where the prejudice is.
Well, actually, with all due respect, Judge Selya, that's just wrong factually.
Yeah.
The damage is done when Mark Howard, who was a former assistant United States attorney, still in the office while the Brown case was being investigated and prosecuted in an actual supervisory capacity at that time.
I'm sorry. I still don't get it. This is a lawyer who he rejects. Are you saying that he had a right to have standby counsel during this period other than Judge Mark Howard, and that is the prejudice? What is the prejudice?
No, Chief Judge. What happens is Mr. Howard walks him in on that second day, having been told by Riley for the second time, I don't want you.
How are his ultimate trial rights prejudiced? That's what we keep asking.
He waives his Fifth Amendment rights and provides all sorts of information that later used against him and the other folks at trial.
That's not in your brief.
But I believe we did raise that in the brief, indicate that he...
Was there a suppression hearing?
Did he move to suppress? Moved to suppress, yes, and there was a suppression hearing on the Mark Howard issue,
which
was resolved against Mr. Riley, while Mr. Riley was actually doing a pretty good job representing himself with me as standby later. But you have to understand, from the time that the damage was done and Mark Howard asked to get out only a couple of weeks after he was appointed, from that time until December, so from September to December 7th, Mr. Riley's demand to not have counsel appointed and to represent himself is not honored. It's not dealt with. He finally gets to represent himself. Contrary to what you said, Judge Selya, he finally gets to represent himself on December 7th. Mm-hmm. And then from December 7th...
How is that contrary to what I said? Are you objecting to the fact that it took the trial judge a couple months to decide his request and the motion to withdraw?
Yes,
and what's the prejudice?
The prejudice is he's not been able to prepare for trial, not been able to act as his own attorney, and at the same time has an attorney who has been appointed for him who he has said, I don't want.
And the attorney's moved to withdraw.
A
defendant has a right to instantaneous action on a motion like that?
No, I'm the second lawyer. He says, well, third, actually, if you count the federal defender up in upstate New York. I'm the second one. He says, when I arrive on the date that they have the hearing on Mr. Howard's motion to withdraw, I come in the back, and he says, during the hearing, don't let that man anywhere near me. You have to understand, it was only...
Counsel, really, we're trying to make sense out of your argument. He didn't want you either.
That's correct.
All right. So is your claim of prejudice that your client's claim that you were appointed as standby counsel?
That I was
is
there.
Is the claim of prejudice that he had standby counsel?
No, I was appointed as full counsel, as
I
was Mr. Howard.
I thought you were first standby counsel.
That's not the status that the court had. The court denied Mr. Riley on the day that Mr. Howard was allowed out and I was appointed. The court denied Mr. Riley the right to represent himself and denied him the right to not have me represent him.
You haven't answered my question. I thought you were initially standby counsel.
No, I eventually became standby counsel in December when Mr. Riley was officially given the right to represent himself. Then for the next 2-3 months, he's denied the ability to prepare because the jail thinks that he has counsel, so they don't let him have access to his materials. And he complains to the court, he makes motions, and many of the motions before he is allowed in December to be his own counsel, with me as standby. Before that, he's filed motions. Those motions are all denied. They're actually not denied, they're stricken, because he's got full counsel that he doesn't want. Those are never, other motions are brought later once he's brought his full counsel. There's even a point when the court says that it's going to address all the motions that he's filed. That never happens, and he's denied the ability the ability to represent himself, the tools necessary to represent himself, both a Sixth Amendment violation, as Ferretta says, it's probably also a due process violation as depriving him of the tools he needs to have his defense.
You seem now to be saying that there is no prejudice showing that he needs to make as to denial of his right to represent himself.
Oh, no. I think that it's not necessary under some aspects of the remember, there's numerous deprivations of his rights here.
I know, but could you answer my question?
Right. For some, he doesn't need to show prejudice. For others, he has shown prejudice. He's got prejudice. We get down to a couple of weeks before trial, there's one hearing where he says, look, I'm still having problems. The jail isn't giving me my stuff. I'm not going to be ready for trial. A week later about, and that's only like a week or 10 days before trial, we're there for the final pretrial conference. And that's when I'm appointed as full trial counsel. I ask for a continuance. It's denied. You know, no way you can be prepared under those circumstances in a week of a trial of this magnitude and complexity. He was completely denied his rights under the Sixth Amendment, and he was denied due process.
Mr. Weberg, may I ask you a question? And I will tell you in advance that you do not have to answer it so far as I'm concerned. It goes to a different issue in this case. As I recall your brief, you argued that there is no legislative territorial jurisdiction either over the situs in Plainfield or the courthouse in Concord. And my question is, do you believe that you have a good faith basis in law to make that argument? And you do not have to answer that question if you don't wish to.
I will answer it. I believe that I do. I believe that there are sometimes issues that are huge issues, things that are out there under the surface that we accept as the way things are done.
Well, your argument is based on the exclusive jurisdiction clause in Article 1, isn't it?
Well, it's also based on the statutes as well, and the fact that the constitutional provision says that you have to have the property ceded by the state to
under the exclusive jurisdiction
right.
clause. Does the word exclusive have any significance in your mind?
I think it relates to the issue of when the United States gets that jurisdiction, then that's that's the United States. Thank you.
Mr. Gordon.
May it please the Court, I'm Joshua Gordon. I represent Cyrano Gonzalez. I want to talk about verdict on count number two. First, on the meaning of the verdict itself, I think it's a special verdict. The jury did not make a finding of forcibly, which is necessary to the 2A conviction, and it used the phrase hinder and prevent, which is peculiar to the 2B charge. So if the verdict is anything, it's only on count 2B. But if I'm wrong, count 2A is a misdemeanor. At most, Mr. Gonzalez's crime was battery. He made a threat to assault, but there was never actually any touching. And the maximum for that is a year, which is the definition of a misdemeanor in the conspiracy statute.
Correct me if I'm wrong, I may be, but wasn't the charge with respect to 2A that he acted forcibly?
Yes.
Well, if he acted forcibly, doesn't that imply something more than simply a symbolic threat? Doesn't it require a touching that could be described as a forcible one?
But there isn't one. There's no touching anywhere in the case. There is certainly a battery, a threat to an assault, a threat to a battery, but there's no actual battery ever occurred.
Okay.
It's a misdemeanor at most, but my client and all three defendants were sentenced as though it were a felony. I wanted to address, if I can, this territorial jurisdiction issue. Of course, Congress can make laws pursuant to its various powers, but enforcing warrants is the job of local police. If the federal government needs authority to enforce in a place, it has to have the consent of the legislature of the state. And in New Hampshire, I think all that is a letter to the Secretary of State.
Well, is that argument based on the exclusive jurisdiction clause,
yes,
too?
That's the same argument I think you asked Mr. Weaver about.
Well, doesn't the word exclusive have any significance here?
I think it does. I think the significance of exclusive is that if the federal government is going to exercise exclusive power in that place, which it did here.
It's not exercising exclusive power.
Well, how is it not?
Do you suggest that the law of the state of New Hampshire was not also applicable in that place?
Oh, I think the law of the state of New Hampshire, of course, is applicable.
Then we don't have an exclusive jurisdiction situation.
Well, this is not...
It's not exclusive. It's overlapping, state and federal. The clause is talking about a situation, as in the District of Columbia, when there is no separate state law. The only law is federal law. We don't have that situation here.
That's exactly the point.
And you've conceded it. You've just conceded your whole point.
No, I don't think so. The fact that New Hampshire is a state means that there is no federal jurisdiction unless the state cedes it.
Well, I don't think we'll get anything by pursuing this, Mr. Gordon.
Okay. Mr. Gonzalez was sentenced for bombs and munitions that he wasn't convicted of. And the record in this case is just replete with lots of explosive things. He was living at the Browns' house for a couple of months, and he told the jury that his two guns were with him for personal protection. And I think they believed him. They did not find him guilty of the 924 charges. But the court overruled, effectively, the jury's finding. It called Mr. Gonzalez's testimony perjurious and named all the ways that it thought it was, and sentenced him anyway for the guns and the explosives.
But hasn't the Supreme Court expressly sanctioned sentencing enhancements based on acquitted conduct, citing the difference in the burden of proof between preponderance and beyond a reasonable doubt?
Yes, it has. There is some limit to that, or there needs to be some limit to that.
Well, the limit is that if, in fact, the facts found by the sentencing court increase the maximum possible penalty, that goes beyond the court's authority. But within sentencing ranges, I don't know of any limitation on the court's power, as Judge Selya just said, to find facts by a preponderance, for example, even though those same facts would have been elements of acquitted conduct, which had to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt.
I think here the judge just overrode the jury's verdict. The jury expressly did not find guilt.
That happens every time a judge grants a sentencing enhancement based on acquitted conduct.
Pardon me?
If that happens every time a judge grants a sentencing enhancement based on conduct for which the jury has acquitted.
Well, that may be true.
It is true.
Okay.
It's undeniably true.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
For Mr. Gonzalez, it meant lots of extra time on something for which he was not convicted.
Are you making a claim there was factual error in applying this enhancement?
Yes, I am.
What was the factual error?
The factual error was that the jury believed that the guns didn't go.
You're not answering the question. You're giving the same argument you gave before. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Seth Aframe for the United States. Let me begin with the double jeopardy argument. Justice Souter began by quoting count one from the brief, and I would note that the count one quote is inaccurate in that it uses the word impede. Impede does not appear in the indictment for count one. Impede does not appear in the statute the part of 372 that's at issue here. The word is prevent. And as the dialogue that preceded earlier indicated, that's one of the points of difference. Does impede mean the same as prevent?
Well, he would say that, okay, you've corrected his quotation, but he would say you've sort of gone from the frying pan into the fire, because he was making the argument that prevent is a broader term than interfere, so that at the most what your argument gets you is an analysis that the one is a lesser included
right.
than the other, in which case you've got a block.
And your initial point answers that. One statute requires force. A 111, what I'll call a 111 conspiracy, requires force. The Disney from the Sixth Circuit, Keimer from the Eighth Circuit say each of the six words in the statute require forcibly. Okay. 372 does not require force. And let me give you a concrete example to sort of draw that into relief. Let's assume.
Well, but correct me again, and this is probably for just faulty memory. I thought he said that his quotation of count one was inaccurate and that there was, in fact, a claim of forcible action there or force used.
The statute quotes the language of the indictment. I'm sorry, the indictment quotes the statute, which
yeah.
says force, threats, intimidation.
Okay, so force was charged in count one.
As an alternative way of proving it, but it
well,
wasn't
but
necessary.
We don't know which of those possible alternatives a jury may have picked. So if you have charged force using statutory language in one, and you have charged force in 2A, then we do have two identical elements. You can't distinguish between the indictments following the statutory language, excuse me, based on force or non-force, because you've charged both, and you're telling me that both, in fact, are correct given the elements set out in the statute.
And I would again, and I would say that even if that's true, that there is certainly a temporal difference as well between 372 and 111A, in that the while engaged in or on account of the duties is not an element of 372. And I would not say that prevent is also necessarily a for 371 111 conspiracy, you do not have to prove that there was any intent to frustrate a government actor from engaging in to frustrate a government action. A simple assault will suffice. So, for example, my case I did not cite in my brief is from the Seventh Circuit called Starks, and they were discussing a multiplicity argument where it was the assault statute, 111, and the obstruction of justice statute. And the court said there that to violate the 111 statute, simply striking an officer while engaged in his duties doesn't mean you had any intent whatsoever to frustrate the performance of the duties. To violate 372.
Is that nonsense?
Is that nonsense? I don't think so. I mean, if I had a private dispute with
you didn't know the officer was in the midst of enforcing his duties.
That under the
have a barroom brawl with him or something.
Right, and that's the Supreme Court's decision in Fiola, where the point there was the status of federal official was a jurisdictional provision in specific intent to harm a federal official, knowing he was a federal official was not required.
I was going to say, isn't there a knowing element there?
Judge
Lynch's example is unanswerable unless there's a knowing element in the statute. Is there?
Knowing that it's a federal official?
Yeah.
Well, I think the Supreme Court said no in Fiola.
Okay, I'll stand.
I mean, that I stand on that is the proposition that Fiola stands for.
Yeah, counsel, you said that Starks isn't in your brief. You'll send us a 28-J letter,
please. I will. I do intend to do that.
Yes, all right.
And I think that not so much
folks. Let's go back. Mm-hmm. You stand by prevent has a different meaning than interfere with.
Yes.
You are also saying there's a different element of someone in the course of performing their duties. That's another distinction you draw. And what is the third distinction?
Well, I made the distinction concerning force, that one requires force. You cannot have a conviction without it.
Yes.
And I had a call from Justice Souter about that. That may be problematic.
If you have any other argument.
Concerning the Blockberger analysis, I mean, I think those are the differences, and I think it, you know, it makes sense. Let me just provide this example to try to draw that out. This more focuses on the Fourth. I mean, it would be a violation of 372 to send a letter to an assist to conspire to send a letter to an assistant United States attorney to say if you charge X person, I will spread malicious gossip to the press. That would not be force. The officer will not be have being engaged in the duties, but it would be to prevent. It certainly would be with the hope of stopping completely the assistant United States attorney from trying to obtain an indictment.
I think the statute requires no charge of force, so that would be a good claim under the statute.
That would be my view, that would be a 372, but could not be charged as a 111.
Uh-huh.
Okay. On the other hand, I think, suppose the example of a conspiracy where we agree we will trip the officer as he runs by. We may impede him, which means to slow the progress of. I think it would be a stretch to say that we had the intent to prevent. That act, I think reasonable minds could agree, isn't going to prevent. It's going to slow down. And that's a difference. And that relates to what happened here.
But you get on a slippery slope, because whether that act prevents or not is going to depend on the facts of the case. If the person the marshals are trying to apprehend is about to get into a fast car or a helicopter and make his escape, tripping the marshals may very well prevent.
Perhaps. I mean, yeah. That doesn't mean that there are not fact patterns where the acts will be prevent. But that's the question: prevent or is it something lesser, which is impede? And that's a decision for juries, charging decisions. But they are getting at different kinds of conduct, and that's a response to the legislative history argument that we didn't really engage in with Mr. Glickman, which is why would you have 372 conspiracies if you had such thing as 111 conspiracies, and you have a 6-year penalty versus a 5-year penalty, and the legislative history says, well, because Congress thought in 1948 that certain kinds of conspiracies needed to be retained to give the higher penalty. Well, one could say that preventing the government, completely trying to stop the government from doing what it needs to do, is a greater harm than the 6 words listed in 111A, and that's a reason to permit these two different conspiracy charges. And it makes sense here. I think that's an important point. What this case is about is an overall idea to act as accessories to try to prevent the arrest of the Browns. Okay? Then they had to effectuate that. Well, how would they do that? They would arm the property, and they would publicize it. And they would make references to what they would do if the marshals decided to come on the property. What was their goal? To stop the marshals from ever coming, to allow the Browns to remain there, and hopefully that status quo would remain. I would say that's a 372. On the other hand, they know that that may not work. And the marshals may come in any event. And then they have to address the question of, well, what will we do if they come on the property? And what we will do is we will try to either assault them, resist them, impede them, or interfere with them. That, in my view, is the 111A aspect of the conspiracy. They cite Braverman. That's obviously a different situation. We have not made multiple conspiracies under the same statute. This is more like Albernez, where you have different conspiracy statutes. Different objects violate different conspiracy laws, and that's the essence of our two charges in this case. I'd like to turn...
You were going to talk about the 2A and 2B?
Yes. I will move to the 2A, 2B argument, which I think is a difficult argument or a difficult issue in the case.
Yes.
You have a general verdict, or at least I contend you have a general verdict. There's a dispute about that, and I don't know that I can add much more to the dialogue about that than what's in the record.
Am I correct in my understanding that no party to the case objected to the form of the special verdict form? Of the verdict form.
At least not on the grounds made here.
Okay. All right.
So I think that's a problem. But let me say that on whether this was a special verdict or a general verdict, and then I want to talk to you about the implications of a general verdict. But let me spend a minute on that question. You know, we don't, this court's precedent is pretty clear, most recently in Edelkind and some other cases. You don't read the jury form divorced from the entire proceeding of the trial. Most specifically, you don't read it divorced from the jury instructions. The jury instructions here are clear. It was a dual object conspiracy, and a conviction would be appropriate for either violating conspiring to violate 111 or conspiring to violate Section 3.
Right. Let me interrupt you again, counsel.
Yes.
There's quite a lot of consternation in the briefs about the supposed variance between the conjunctive use of the terminology in the indictment and the disjunctive use of the terminology in the jury instruction. Am I correct in understanding that there was no contemporaneous objection to the jury instruction on that ground?
You're incorrect on that point.
Okay.
There was contemporaneous objection, and I would say that argument is resolved by this court's decision in Capozzi, where Judge Campbell recognized that it's the usual course to charge a dual object conspiracy in the conjunctive and to charge the jury in the disjunctive. And that's exactly what we have in this case. So I think the meatier question, I guess, is, well, what did the jury... So the instructions, in my view, were very clear. You can convict of count two by either A or B. And then you have a jury form for count two that in one part that uses the words prevent or hinder, which comes from Section 3, and then quotes part of the indictment that says to arrest Edward and Elaine Brown, which comes from the object B. So basically the verdict form merged to part of object A with part of object B. And then the question is, well, what was that telling us? And the only way to know what it was telling us is to look at the indictment, to look at the jury instructions, and to look at the reality of the trial, which is no one at any time said that the court was going to be taking away one of the objects from the jury's consideration. I mean, you can read the entire record and there won't be one hint of that. So my view is it's a general verdict. If you accept that, then the question is, what does that mean? What does that mean for sentencing under count two? And you have two, so you have, the argument is that count 2A is a misdemeanor, and therefore you have to default to the misdemeanor penalty, even though count 2B may well indeed be a felony. My view on that is that's incorrect. My view would be that when you're interpreting a general verdict, the Supreme Court has said in two cases the methodology that you use to do that, in Griffin and then in Shorer. And the Supreme Court said in those cases that you assume, that you use a presumption. And the presumption is the jury convicted of those objects of the conspiracy that were supported by the facts. And here both were supported by the facts. The 2A conspiracy was supported by the facts. The 2B conspiracy was supported by the facts. So I would say that the presumption that Griffin and Shorer talk about is applies here so that they can be sentenced as if convicted of both objects. Now, if you disagree with that, then the question becomes, how do you handle the problem in 2A? Because I do think that there's an Apprendi problem in 2A. 2A talks about simple assault having one penalty, and at the time, the statute has since been changed, but at that time said all other cases subject to a stiffer penalty, a felony penalty of 8 years. And so, and the jury was not asked to distinguish between the simple assault and what I'm going to call for shorthand the aggravated assault. So the question becomes then, if that's an Apprendi error, did it harm the defendants? And I think the answer is no. For two of the defendants, this argument wasn't raised at all, and so it's a plain error standard. For Mr. Gonzalez, it was raised in the PSI and vaguely alluded to at the sentencing hearing, so perhaps for him it's harmless error. But I would say under whatever standard of review the court applies, it's a harmless error. Because the distinction between simple assault and the aggravated assault in several cases have explained this distinction. Hathaway, Gagnon, Yates, these are all circuit court opinions, and they've said that a simple assault is an assault without touching. An aggravated assault is either a touching, use of dangerous weapons, or the intent to commit another felony. Now, I would say that on all three, the evidence here is overwhelming. But let me talk for a minute about intent to commit another felony. The overall scheme here was to be accessories after the fact for the Browns. The 372 conspiracy and the 111A conspiracy were ways of effectuating that overall purpose. They were all convicted of accessory after the fact. There's no way to articulate what happened here as a simple assault, because what the 111A object obviously was had to have been part of the overall intent to commit the felony of accessory after the fact. And so in that way, my argument would be that even if there's an Apprendi error, and you think that you would have to, you couldn't just have the 60-month maximum because of count 2B, which is my primary argument, secondarily, it would be a harmless error. Or didn't affect substantial rights, depending on the particular defendant. That's my answer on the count two situation. Let me turn briefly to Mr. Weberg's discussion, just so I can put the government's position on the record. I think this was precisely what this court's Proctor case requires. Proctor, by Judge Coffin, recognizes that there's an inherent, judges are in a trap because there are competing rights. You have your right to counsel, and you have your Faretta right. And what Proctor says is that's a problem, and the way we get out of that problem is we value the right to counsel over the right to Faretta when they are in conflict, or when a defendant is changing his mind. And that's what you have here. You have a defendant who was unhappy with the initial representation early in the trial, decided to go pro se, went pro se, unsuccessfully in his mind, and we heard that the various motions were denied. Well, I would argue that if those motions were improperly denied, then those should be appealed. But they were not. Later, as is approaching trial, he comes to the court, and I think this court will be satisfied that he gives a knowing, willing waiver of his previous assertion of Faretta to have counsel. That's what the law requires. Judge Singal did exactly what Proctor requires, which is to favor that request over the earlier Faretta request.
What about counsel's somewhat separate complaint that he did not have enough time to prepare for trial?
Well, the fundamental problem that I point out in the brief is, on appeal, he has not met this court's standard for showing that a continuance should have been granted. This court has been clear that because these claims are hard to argue on appeal, because one can always use more time, you have to specifically identify what it is you would have done that you didn't have time to do. And his brief is bereft on that point. He was standby counsel. He was involved in the case. Judge Singal was certainly a lot closer to the case than any of us are. And he made the determination that Mr. Weber had sufficient time to prepare. And nothing now gives a real basis for disputing that. So under the abuse of discretion standard that would apply to that claim, I don't think that it has merit. Let me turn to the accessory after the fact indictment argument that did not get raised earlier, but I think it's a significant question that we should discuss. The indictment does, in my view, by incorporating the opening paragraphs which describe what the Browns did, does adequately charge the accessory after the fact count. The counter argument, I guess, is that there are other kinds of accessory after the fact that could be charged. And I think that's true. Theoretically, I mean,
wasn't the salient point here that they had been convicted and we are at the point where they're trying to avoid arrest and avoid the marshals arresting
them? That is my salient point.
And therefore, the precise content of what the conviction was about is not nearly as relevant as it would be at a pretrial stage.
Correct. That's my salient point. That's my distinction of the cases that were raised by the other side. To be fair, at least my research indicates that's a question of first impression. I'm not aware of any cases, reported cases, discussing the punishment prong of accessory.
Does the indictment allege that the convictions were for tax offenses?
I would say that it does by incorporating the background section of the indictment.
And what does the background section say?
The background section of the indictment discusses that the Browns on January 17th, 2006 or 7, I believe, were convicted of conspiracy in federal tax crimes. Then at trial, we introduced the arrest warrant that identified the charges against the Browns and provided testimony that the defendants were convicted. And then each of the defendants, there was evidence that they knew that.
I was going to say the important point is what they knew,
right,
isn't it?
Right. So one, it was in terms of a sufficiency argument, we presented evidence, one, that there were convictions, and two, there was evidence as to each that they knew that the Browns had been convicted of federal offenses. Those are the issues that I thought were the most significant. I can discuss briefly the gun issue that was raised earlier. I think Judge Selya was correct. Under this court's decision in Gobi, acquitted conduct, of course, may be used for an enhancement. There's no clear error here. I think that argument was made. The court will see when it reviews the trial evidence. There was a video of Mr. Gonzalez with the Browns with a gun, an assault or a rifle over his shoulder. So, you know, I think it's difficult under the clear error standard to think that just Judge Singal was clearly wrong to make that determination. If there are no other questions, I'll rest on the arguments in my brief. So thank you for the time.
All right. Thank you very much.